the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
Later this year, a 60 billion rand class action suit against the banks is expected to be heard, brought by several hundred homeowners who say their properties were unlawfully repossessed and sold for a fraction of their worth. One of the architects of that case is Advocate Douglas Shaw, along with the Lungelu Letu Human Rights Foundation. It's been a long and agonizing process, lasting several years to get to this point, but it seems things are now moving towards a court date. One of the arguments being made by Advocate Douglas Shaw is to help solve the problem of home foreclosure in South Africa by allowing investors outside of the banks to buy distressed mortgage bonds. In other words, to encourage the banks to securitize these mortgage bonds, log them on a public blockchain for the world to see, and test whether there's a market for these admittedly sometimes risky assets. This is not entirely a new idea. If you've ever watched the Netflix movie The Big Short, where a group of maverick investors saw the incoming wave of mortgage defaults in the United States market and decided to profit from it, you get a rather good explanation for what is known as securitization. The only problem with the US model was that the banks were less than transparent about the state of default in the underlying mortgage bonds. Better disclosure would have made the collapse of the mortgage market less severe, and there's no doubt about that. It's certainly a discussion worth having in South Africa, and today I'm talking to Advocate Douglas Shaw about the class action suit and some suggestions to fix what is clearly a major problem for the country. Hi, Douglas. Welcome to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. First of all, tell us about the 60 billion rand class action suit against the banks and where it sits at the moment.
Okay, thank you, Kieran. Well, first of all, the class action itself is designed to force our banks, who will do nothing right if they're not forced to do so, to pay back to the people whose homes they've sold for as little as 100 rand over the last, more than almost 30 years since the Constitution came in, and when they have not done it as a last resort. And in most cases, probably they haven't done it as a last resort. There's many situations where they've not done it as a last resort. So we've been working on this class action for quite a while, and the banks have been trying to delay it. But we do expect that they can't delay it forever. And they keep bringing up things, but the list of things they can bring up is now reducing significantly. And so we're hoping we're going to get the certification part of this hearing heard before the end of the year. This is our hope, if we can get through with that. And one of the things, as Kieran mentioned, we have opposed many times securitization. We have stood up in court and said this Absa or Standard Bank cannot come and claim this house, to sell this house of this person, client of ours, because this bond has probably been securitized. And all that happens is that because of the way securitization is done in this country, the bank just says, no, this one hasn't been securitized, even though we do securitize, it's in our accounts, this one not. And we then have the responsibility of proving that it is, which is impossible to do because we don't have the records. So we've generally been against the securitization, and there have been cases where the bank's been caught because they've either come as the securitized entity, the new entity that now owns the bond has come, and they haven't been able to prove that they've ceded it to that entity, or it has been shown by some way that they have securitized the entity and are still coming as Absa or Standard Bank. So there have been times, but so it might be quite strange to people that have heard me talk about this before that I am now advocating more securitization, and I'll talk about that in a little while.
All right, so I think we probably need a bit of an explanation about what is securitization. My understanding is that is when you have a whole bunch of mortgage bonds, maybe several thousand of them, you package them together and you put them into a bond, which is then traded on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And that has a credit rating. And one of the things they're expected to disclose is the default rate How many people have stopped paying their mortgage bonds? And I think with a lot of these securitized mortgage bonds, they have insurance policies layered on top that protects them against that. But they're also required to disclose, if I'm not mistaken, what is the default rate. Have I got that right?
Oh, that's actually a contractual matter between the bank's securitization entity and the bank, how much they're supposed to disclose. But what actually happens in South Africa, and this is not necessary, and I think in a lot of countries, is they market these securitized entities as being pristine, right? So these are bonds that are not defaulting. So if they have a bond within that securitized entity, which is basically just a company, just see it as a company that owns the rights now to thousands of bonds that previously were owned by Absa. So they've been ceded to this new entity. Then Absa, or whoever it is, will take another, or maybe in a year they've got five that have defaulted maybe. And these five, they just take them out of the securitized entity and put another five in that haven't defaulted. So they keep it absolutely pristine. That's the way they run their securitized entities. The problem in America during the financial crisis was fraud. You can't call it anything other than fraud. They were selling, these investment banks in America were selling entities that they knew had bonds that were not AAA rated. And they said they were AAA rated. And they sold them to all over the world, to a lot to German Landesbank and other financial entities around the world, completely fraudulently, knowing that these weren't AAA-rated things at all. So that was the problem there. Whereas you've got other nations such as Denmark that's been running securitized systems effectively for decades and decades without having any of the problems that the American securitized market had. So it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. And the way that we're doing it in this country suffers from the lack of transparency. I don't know if I could call it fraud, but it's because they may be doing between entities what they're supposed, what they're accurately reflecting, but we can definitely see lack of transparency. And then my big point, that they don't seem to be doing it with the bonds that are in default. In fact, they remove them from the securitized entity. Now, our constitutional court has ruled in JAFTA that a bank mustn't sell, sell somebody's house in execution unless it's a last resort. Now, if that bond could be sold to somebody else who's willing to hold it for a while, you know, nurture that person out of debt and get their financials right and so that they can hold on to their house, then it's not a last resort if they haven't given that option. And I know that that's not ever been done by our banks. So it's when they've never given people the option, so they'd have to give it at a discount. But a bank, when they sell a house in execution, they don't usually, at the moment, even with reserve prices, it's great that we've got reserve prices now, they still only sell properties for about 50 to 70% of their value. Other countries sell them for 100% of their value, 90%, 80% at the very least. We're still selling for less than value.
Yeah, I think we better talk about reserve price. What is a reserve price? It's a floor price, isn't it? So what the judges are empowered now to say, you cannot sell this property for less than 70% of its market worth. Previously, properties were being sold for 1,000 rand, and this is all disclosed in your papers, even 100 rand, even 10 rand, believe it or not. Now, those are not genuine sales. Those are fictitious sales.
Yes, that's absolutely right. We have a spreadsheet with thousands and thousands of records from the banks themselves with the price they thought the house was worth. And 1% of their value, 0.2% of their value. And they've been doing this before the Constitution, in Joburg for 100 years, in Cape Town and Durban for 50 years. They've been selling houses for far, far less than they're worth. And this doesn't really happen to this degree in any other country in the world. That's the thing. Everybody thinks, oh, well, that's what banks have to do to operate. No, it's not. They absolutely don't. And it was a major breakthrough for this movement, for ourselves, to get reserve prices so that it's now not these ridiculous levels, but still 50 to 70% is not good enough. One of the things that they could be doing is securitizing the properties that are in default, not the pristine properties. They can do that as well if they want. I have no objection, as long as they're transparent about it, do it right. But what they should do is they should put out to the market and say, look, we've got, and all the details, there will be different classifications of different types of bonds, different types of securities, which are, okay, these ones are this much in arrears, they're 3 months in arrears, they're 6 months in arrears, and they're all different categories, but they'd be at a discount to their market value, to the value of the bond. But the bank would still get more money in that case from than they would from trying to sell it in execution. Selling in execution is a very inefficient process in this country. So given that they can do that, they have an obligation to do it because JAFTA says unless it's a last resort, they can't sell in execution. So the fact that they're doing all these securitizations, very clever investment-wise, they think they're very clever. Why don't they use them for the people that are in the most need? So that they don't get all this bad press that they're getting now for being completely abandoning their clients and being completely unnecessarily nasty to their clients, when they could actually go out into the market and say, look, we're going to give you this bond at 20% off, 30% off, whatever, as long as you hold that bond for three years or something like that. Or there would be a complicated legal framework around it, but it could work. Definitely could work. And we'd have to feel our way and see what's practical. But definitely it would be a way ahead that banks, as they usually don't, they have no concern in this area for their clients. And so they innovate in so many areas. Why haven't they just thought, well, why don't we sell our bonds that are in problems to people who would then become specialized companies and going to these people, and instead of acting with arrogance and lack of concern, they would say, how can we make this work? And they would go through all the things that we say banks don't do as a last resort, talk to the actual client about it and say, look, we can get you out of this. Maybe you could rent this out and you could stay with your friends or whatever for a while until we get your bond up. Maybe you could you've got a friend that can pay this bond for you for a while. Okay, great, let's do that. You know, whereas banks sometimes sell them regardless, you know. Oh, you've got a new job. Well, what's the problem? Let's just, you know, look at this bond and refinance it, and we've got a bond. And these people would then be getting their 20% discount on the bond, or this arbitrary figure, whatever it is. And they would be earning that by actually working with the client. And the client would obviously be much better off because he doesn't have to lose his house for half the price. And sometimes people have a really strong connection to their house. So it's not just the financial value, it's the losing where they were brought up, where their kids were brought up, etc. There's a lot more to the home than just a house. So there's that as well. So this is why I am saying banks should actually be doing more securitization.
That's interesting. A few weeks back, I had Glenn Jordan from a company called Empower. They're using the blockchain in an entirely different way to fund mortgage properties, the purchase of houses across Africa. And the stats are that only 3% of people in Africa qualify for a mortgage bond. So the existing banking model is not going to work if you are going to solve this backlog across the country. And it's a 50 million house backlog, I'm told. But the way that they do it is different. And he does critique the way the banks go. They have, you know, their credit committees. You've got to have a job. You've got to be able to show a salary slip. But if you're in the informal sector, you don't have that. But what Empower does is they go in and they look at the entire household and says, okay, so how much did you earn last month? Well, I earned 2,000 Rand. Have you got any proof of that? They're not interested in that because there will be no paperwork. But they can see through bank activity that there is a certain amount of money that is going through the household. And on that basis, they can fund the purchase of actually a very nice house. So it is time to start challenging whether the banks are very stuck in a credit rating mindset. And by the way, I did want to bring up the point about the blockchain, because I think this is critical to the discussion. There's been a lot of talk in South Africa about companies and government sharing more information. People hold on to their data, and it's like this is our property, it's our IP, our intellectual property. But worldwide, there's a lot more sharing of this information between companies for the public good. And this is one of the suggestions that you're making, is that banks, they could anonymize it to a certain extent, so you don't have the people's names and so on, but that you could see which mortgage bonds are in distress and make that available on a public blockchain. Then attached to that, you could have all kinds of financial instruments that are leveraged off of that public blockchain. People could start securitizing, as you suggested. Maybe just explain how you see that going.
Yes, of course, blockchains have transformed many things in life and have got potential to transform much more. But yes, it democratizes the process. It says that everyone can then buy these securitized assets, and perhaps as the management company, who is the people that actually go and see the person and sort out. But behind that, there can be 1,000 people that have bought and through a blockchain system into this model without having to be major investors with 100,000 minimum to spend. And it's all controlled by the blockchain process and kept secure through that. So you don't need to trust the government, you don't need to trust big companies because the blockchain's there to keep track of it all for you. And one more thing to say on that, the spreadsheet I'm talking about with these thousands and thousands of names, we've anonymized it in a very simple way just by taking the names out. But you can download it from our website and possibly the website here as well. And it's you can circulate it freely. And everybody must have a look at this just so you can see the amount of houses sold. And this is just over a couple of years, these records. But it's obviously been going on for some time. Everybody should look at it because you will be shocked at the prices that many houses have been sold for. To see the actual thing has an effect on you.
You mentioned this database that you have of properties that were sold. You made that public. In fact, we published it in MoneyWeb some years ago. But the National Credit Regulator actually fought you on that. Now, I would have thought that the regulator would have been on the side of the public. But in this case, it looked like they were out batting for the banks. Well, what was that about?
Yeah, it was a big surprise to us as well. So when you make a court case, you actually, as respondents, as well as the bank, you put in a lot of people that you expect to be on your side. But you've got to include them. For example, if you want somebody to, the banks to transfer a house back from somebody, a buyer to your client, then you've got to cite the deeds registry. If you want a law changed, you've got to cite the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development. So we cited four institutions that we thought were going to be on our side. Minister of Constitutional Development, Justice and Constitutional Development was one. NCR was another, because the reason I had this database is many years ago, the NCR were the ones that were going to fund the case that we're doing now. And only when they started looking into reserve prices, the rules board, they said, okay, let's leave it until after that. But they never got around to doing it. And the South African Human Rights Commission were also there, and the rules board themselves. But none of the people, they were all people. I mean, you say in your papers, you're not seeking an order against them. They have an interest. And we were hoping that some of them would come forward and say, yes, even just a one or two page affidavit saying we support this, we think the bank should pay this, something like that. But unfortunately, none of them have come forward with any kind of help. But the NCR, most surprising, since they were the ones that were going to work with us in the past, for them to come forward and say, no, you can't use these records. And it makes you think, and they deny this vehemently, but that they've been captured by the banks. I also often worry that the banks try and capture journalists and say, we're not going to give you any advertising if And lawyers also, you know, they say, well, look, if you don't expect to get any convincing business for registering bonds if you sue us or defend people against us. So there's questions to be looked into. There should be laws against that, basically. It's making the market less competitive. It's just wrong. So we must look into things like that as well.
I think one of the problems that you have with the existing system of the banks and the whole interaction with the courts and the law is they outsource their services to a panel, these outside law firms. And I've come across so many cases which are just illogical and frankly nasty on their face, that where there seems to be, they're so cold that they would rather evict somebody. And this is a case we reported on in MoneyWeb quite recently, where somebody had to fend off, this is a single mom with a child, had to fend off multiple attempts to evict her, even though she'd caught up on her arrears and reinstated her bond, right? Which in terms of the Encarta judgment, also another constitutional court case, said that if you catch up on your arrears and you pay reasonable costs, then your mortgage bond is reinstated. You don't have to go to court to affirm that, right? It is automatic. And yet, some banks, in some cases, still trying to go that route. And I cannot understand it, why they do not find a more humane way to do that. And where are the checks and balances in the banks to make sure that that kind of injustice is not happening?
Yes, in Qatar, if you're caught up in your arrears, and there's no, the costs have not either been taxed or agreed. So even if you haven't paid any legal costs at all, it's still caught up, in my view. And then if they go to the taxing master, which they rarely do, which is the way they work out what their legal costs were in court, then you would have to pay that as well. But they often don't. So yes, there's definitely... And Kata says, if you've caught up yet. But yes, the question really is, why are the bank's lawyers so nasty? Because I have found, I go to court, obviously I've done it, I don't know how often, but over 100 times, defending people against banks. And I've also been involved in other legal cases, not against banks. And the advocates and the lawyers that deal for the banks just seem, not all of them, but often they seem just heartlessly nasty and vindictive, and they're not trying to do the right thing. They're not even trying to. They'll go to court. I've had people go to court without telling me they're going to court, which is totally against the rules. And then they say, no, we told them. And I never got anything to say that there was a court date on this. I was never informed. And this is so against the rules. But only you only get this from bank lawyers. You know, when you're with lawyers and other matters, even though it's high stakes and so on, you'll be civil. They'll be civil. It'll be the advocates will shake hands and, you know, like, you know, even help each other pass documents if you can't find them. I was in one recently and I was thinking, this is so different from, and so there's something wrong, you know, and it's, we need legislation, I think, to define, okay, when can the, you know, the banks know that they can't sell except as a last resort. They plead in their papers in our class action, they only sell as a last resort. So they're not denying that they don't have to only sell as a last resort, but they don't know what a last resort is. You know, they have no conception. A last resort is when they think it's a last resort. And actually, if you think about it logically, surely if a person is now able to pay his bond, it's not a last resort. And so we actually need to define these things in legislation. I've drafted a short act that just says that, you know, the banks may not sell, or a creditor might not, mustn't sell a house when these circumstances occur. And just the way we're talking just now, I would also like to put in that legislation something about the banks having to have, or there being a third party that they have to have a meeting with in order to talk about all these options. Now, that is the law in my doctorate. I went through all the 50 countries maybe. So I think it was the Netherlands where this is required, where they there has to have a meeting. And to me, it has to almost be a third party, because otherwise it would become a nominal thing. It's just, oh, we had our meeting, tick.
An independent third party.
Yeah. It would almost be like, you know, they set up debt counselors for in the National Credit Act. It's like it becomes a new profession for people, and they can't be paid by the banks. Like the banking ombudsman is paid by the banks. I don't think that's a good idea. I think they should be paid directly by the government, and maybe the banks should be taxed, but it shouldn't be a direct payment relationship. I think that's maybe what goes wrong. But yeah, I would like to see that, because I just have so much experience of the banks not acting rationally, acting in a way that... And by the way, the argument is not that they should give people as much time as they need. It's more a question of, here's a way to resolve the problem to everybody's advantage. And there's at least 20 ways to do that that are not being used, but are used somewhere in the world. So that's basically what my doctorate did. It said, look, there's all these other ways. There's all these other things we could be doing. Why did the banks not do that? As soon as the Constitution came in, somebody at the bank should have said, but wait, guys, we can't keep doing what we've been doing. And what we didn't even do historically. I mean, in the 19th century, the banks didn't do these things in South Africa, you know? It's just crazy. And back in Roman times, people weren't allowed to sell for less than a reasonable price, you know? And so we're doing things that have not been done in the whole of history and in the whole of the world. People don't realize it's like that bad. And the banks don't. I don't think that, well, the banks don't want to hear it, but there needs to be a revolution. There needs to be a total transformation of the way that the banks work in this country.
Just final question, Douglas. I am hearing from some lawyers like yourselves, I don't know if you agree with this because I haven't asked you yet, that there is better behavior from the banks. In other words, that the abuses which you raise in your papers are less than they were.
Yes, I think they are. And it's because there have grown up a group of lawyers that have been opposing them, and because we've managed to get legislation through and a series of court cases that have stopped the banks doing what they were doing. So they've kind of been forced to be better, because it's drawn to their attention. But I do think, but some banks are better than others, of course. Some banks really have responded to this, and some banks still want to work the old way. But yes, I think it's been a long fight. I think when I first stood up in court and started arguing for clients, maybe, I don't know, 12 years ago, you could get some judges that wouldn't even hear you. It was only a question. I've been, at that time, maybe 5 or 6 cases where all that happened is the other advocate stood up and said, is the person in arrears, do they have a contract, mortgage, matter finished? And the judge agreed with them, and that was it. And I was amazed, after preparing a long case about why this wasn't the case, you know, because this last resort thing has been in 2005, you know, that came in. So yes, it is getting better, which is great. I'm very encouraged by the fact we got the reserve price rules changed, because it restores my faith in the system to some degree. You know, it makes me think, okay, whatever the banks want to do, justice moves slowly. You know, it's a conservative thing, and it probably should be. But eventually our justice system recognizes, okay, this isn't good, let's change it. And when they changed it properly. They said it was a constitutional violation in these cases in 2018, which helps us with our class action, because if it's a constitutional violation, it goes right back to when the Constitution came in. There's no 3 years ago or whatever. It's like right back. It's never been limited by the Constitutional Court. So yes, I applaud the South African justice system for bringing in reserve prices in 2017. But now, this year, I've thought to myself, wait, that was quite a long time ago now. We're still selling for only 50 to 70%. We've still got a sheriff system that isn't advertising the internet, putting lower deposit prices, all the things that would bring in more people to buy. The system is such that the people don't want to show people around their house to sell it, because they don't trust the people that are doing it, the banks. And these kind of things, there's 20, 30 ways to improve the system that will bring up prices. And that's good for the banks as well, but they don't want to change. But certainly, I believe our justice system will eventually, we'll win in the end. The banks will have to recompense the people for what they've done. And they can afford to do so. It's not as if it's going to break our banks. It's less than 1 year's income, 60 billion. And, you know, we might not get 60 billion. We might get 1 billion or 500 million or something. But whatever we get will make a huge, huge difference in the lives of the people whose lives have been ruined. People that came out of, I feel most sorry for the people that were victims of apartheid. They came out of apartheid. They built their way up in this new South African democracy. They had a house. They had equity in their house. They were going to retire okay, you know, in a hugely transformed manner. These are the real transformed people. And then the bank came along and sold their house for 100 rand. I mean, how evil is that? Let's face it, it's evil.
Well, the discussion about arrears is really a discussion for another day. Leonard Benjamin, who is a legal advisor, has proven, I think, very convincingly that the banks recapitalize arrears. Every time there's an interest rate change, if you just pay the new installment after the interest rate has changed, you're now up to date on your arrears. And I think there's a court case coming there as well very soon, which will be explosive. Just on the point of people getting houses repossessed for ridiculous amounts of money, I went out to Cosmo City, and I remember it very well, where a person was evicted from their homes for an arrears of 6,000 rand. Now, come on. This is not serious behavior. We're going to leave it there. Advocate Douglas Shaw, thanks very much for joining us on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kieran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.